Hello and well, welcome to everybody today at Ledbury Poetry Festival. And just to say a very big thank you to Arts Council England, and this wouldn't be possible without them. I have great pleasure in introducing Maitreya Bandhu.
He You've been practicing my name.
I've been practicing all day. His first pamphlet, The Bond, won the poetry book and pamphlet competition and was also shortlisted for the Michael Marks Award. And Vita Brevis, his second pamphlet, won the IOTA Shorts Award and is a Poetry Book Society pamphlet recommendation. His first full-length collection, The Crumb Road by Blood Axe, is a Poetry Book Society recommendation too. And Yarn, his second collection, also with Blood Axe, was published in autumn 2015. Maitreya Bandhu has been a member and has been ordained in the Buddhist order and been a member for 26 years and is the author of 3 books on Buddhism. They're all for sale at the end when you can get them signed as well. Best-selling Life with Full Attention, a practical course in mindfulness. And he lives and works in the London Buddhist Centre. And I'm going to hand over to Maitreya Bandhu to introduce us to a wonderful acclaimed Indian poet, Arundhati Subramanian. Thank you. Big hand, please.
So welcome everyone, really good to see so many of you here just today, that's really good. Particularly welcome to Arundhati, but I'll welcome her properly in a moment. So I'd like to start, this is Poetry East on Tour. Is this slightly too mind? This is Poetry East on Tour. So this is why we travel with the Buddha everywhere we go. So I want to say something a little bit, very briefly, about why I founded Poetry East. I live and work at the London Buddhist Centre, and I have lived there very many years indeed. I want to say something about why I founded it, and then we're going to do a very brief meditation just to settle ourselves down for the reading and for the interview, and then we'll go on from there. I've been rereading Wallace Stevens. In fact, I am rereading Wallace Stevens at the moment with a new biography, a wonderful new biography, called The Whole or Entire Harmonium. Very, very good. I'd recommend it. And, of course, one of the famous things people pull out of Stevens is that God and the imagination are one. One of his famous sort of... It's not a quote. People pull it out of the poem, and there's dangers in that, isn't there? But God and the imagination are one. And I was, of course, really struck by that. And what you get in Stevens' work is somebody quite clearly moving away from belief in a deity, in a Christian God, but nevertheless asserting imagination as the counterpoint to God, as what God is getting at, really. And when Stevens talks like that, he gets very close to Buddhism indeed. So one of the things that I've been trying to do with Poetry East is find ways of interviewing, being in conversation with some of the best poets across the world, Robert Hass from America, Robert Gray from Australia, Arundhati Subramanian from India. And I've been trying to find ways of talking to them in which we can really see what the imagination can do. That the imagination is our great human gift. It's really what makes us human. And when we come to talk about the imagination, really Buddhism, meditation, mindfulness and poetry all come together in one experience, really. So that's why I've been running these Poetry East events. So I'm very, very pleased to be doing this in partnership with the Ledbury Festival. This is the second time that we've worked together in partnership, thanks to Chloe's very visionary sense of what poetry is about. Chloe, I don't know whether you know Chloe, she's the director of the festival. She's one of those visionary risk takers, which you always look out for. Sometimes you can feel that they're a dying breed. You know, it's so easy just to do the things you do and so on, but Chloe takes risks, and I really want to applaud that. So let's start by just quietening for a moment, just doing a very brief meditation. So if you'd like to sit with your feet flat on the ground and your hands together. And if you're happy to, just you close your eyes. So when you close your eyes, you have this sense of your mind, and so often our mind is all over the place. Sometimes our mind can be a million miles from here, but our body is actually present. So see if you can step out of your mind, out of thinking, planning, and so on, into the direct sensation of your body. So see if you can feel the support of the chair. You don't need to give, you know, you can just feel that. You don't need to think about that support. Your weight is supported, and you can give your weight to the chair. And you can feel your feet on the floor. See if you can actually feel the weight of your legs dropping down through your feet. And just see if you can tell if you're a bit tense in your shoulders. So many of us spend our lives just hooked over a computer. Just see if you can take your mind and feel your shoulders and see if you can just let them go. And see if you can tell if you're holding your belly in. We're very often pulling our belly in and up, and we don't even notice that we're doing that. But it affects our mind, it affects our sense of ourselves. So see if you can soften your belly. And if you can soften your belly, you'll start to notice that you can feel your breath coming in and going out. And especially just see if you can focus on your out-breath. So calming the mind, calming your body, soothing your breath. And then just coming back to this sense of your weight on the chair, that you can give your weight to the chair. And then when you're ready, opening your eyes. So we ask our guest poet at Poetry East to recommend two poems that have influenced them that we read out beforehand. So I'm going to ask Sinamanas to read a poem by Aram Kolatkar. Is that good enough? We're all struggling with names today. So, Sinamanas.
an old woman. An old woman grabs hold of your sleeve and tags along. She wants a 50 pace a coin. She says she will take you to the horseshoe shrine. You've seen it already. She hobbles along anyway and tightens her grip on your shirt. She won't let you go. You know how these old women are. They stick to you like a burr. You turn around and face her with an air of finality. You want to end the farce. When you hear her say, "What else can an old woman do on hills as wretched as these?" You look right at the sky, clean through bullet holes she has for her eyes, and as you look on, the cracks that begin around her eyes spread beyond her skin, and the hills crack, and the temples crack, and the sky falls with a plate glass clatter around the shatterproof crone who stands alone, and you are reduced to so much small change in her hand.
And then another poem by Namalavar.
The paradigm. We here, and that man, this man, and that other in between, and that woman, this woman, and that other, whoever, those people, and these others in between, this thing, that thing, and this other in between, whichever. All things dying, these things, those things, those others in between, good things, bad things, things that were, that will be. Being all of them, he stands there.
Thank you very much, Simon. That's really lovely. So I've been reading Arundhati's poems. I've been reading the two collections that she has published by Blood Axe. Where I Live, New and Selected Poems, and When God is a Traveller. When God is a Traveller I'm not surprised, actually. It's a Poetry Book Society choice and was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Award. She's also written a book called The Book of the Buddha, which seems very, very appropriate. She's a poetry editor, a curator, a journalist on literature and classical dance and theatre. Her poems are, the thing that's been striking me particularly reading the poems is they have this beautiful poise between poignancy and loss and wit and this lovely, very distinctive kind of wisdom. So I'm very, very excited to meet Arundhati and very pleased to be in conversation with her. Ladies and gentlemen, Arundhati Subramaniam. Lovely to meet you in person after meeting you in the poems. So can you tell us a little bit about your choice?
These two poems?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for reading them as well as you did. The first is a poem by Arun Kolatkar, who is a 20th century Indian poet. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
He's a 20th century English Indian poet, bilingual, and to my mind perhaps one of the most remarkable poets of the second half of the 20th century in from that part of the world. There are many reasons why I like Kolatkar. Mm. One is just the precision of image that you always find in Kolatkar. You know, the ability to look long and hard at something, keeping the faith that if you look long and hard at it, that it will be transfigured in some way. That you don't have to sentimentalize, you don't have to editorialize, it's not necessary. You know, that kind of precision is something that draws me to his work. But this particular poem is from a book called Jezuri, which is an entire cycle of poems about a visit to a pilgrimage town in India. And it's often been seen, this book, it was published in 1972, I think, it's often been seen as a denunciation of the notion of pilgrimage. You know, a kind of very rationalist look at all the hocus-pocus and superstition that surrounds the sacred. But to my mind, in this poem, there is a difference, because it is, in fact, a poem where there is a moment of very real darshan, what we call darshan, beholding the divine, except that the beholding happens in a place where you least expect to find it. It doesn't happen in the temple. It happens in his encounter with this beggar woman. And to my mind, that moment, when the poem starts with this very specific encounter with a woman and then just opens up so credibly, so believably into something enormous, you know, that still takes my breath away when I hear it. The second is a poem by Nammalvar, who's a 9th century Tamil poet. He's a mystic poet, and a particularly important one, because he stands at the forefront, really, of a whole incredible tradition of Vaishnava devotion. But I chose this, this particular poem, I think, has been important for many reasons, but the most important reason is the fact that it's just the most inclusive praise poem to the divine that I know, you know? It's an ability to talk about the divine, but there is room for everything and everyone and nothing left out. And the kind of, that hospitality of vision, you know, where everything in between is included, that kind of inclusiveness, to my mind, makes it very special. But it's also part of this incredible tradition of bhakti poetry. And bhakti poetry is a certain upsurge of devotional poetry in India that began in the southern part of India between the 6th and 8th centuries and then spread like wildfire all over the country, mainly because it is unimaginably democratic, non-hierarchical, intimate, subversive. You can talk to this divine, this new conception of the divine, can be talked to any way you like. You can love God, you can hate God, you can ridicule God, you can feel lust for God, you can cannibalize God, infantilize God, personalize God, anything is possible. Nothing is transgressive, everything is permissible. And that's just based on a very fundamental assumption that the beloved and the lover cannot be kept apart for very long, however hard they try. So it gives rise to this wonderful tone that I think is never heard before in poetry from that country, and perhaps in many parts of the world. I'm not quite sure there's anything like it. This tone where you're allowed to throw a tantrum in verse and call it prayer, you know? Nammalvar is part of that glorious tradition.
I mean, it's interesting just hearing that. It just shows me how ignorant I am of that tradition.
I hope you'll enjoy the book. It's all in this particular book that I just gifted you. Eating God. You can actually eat God in these poems and enjoy him. You know, there's a lovely poem by Jana, by a woman mystic from Maharashtra. And she says, I eat God. I drink God. Void is not devoid of God. And she says, when I'm done with God, there's God to spare. So it's special, really. It's wonderful poetry.
So I want to turn away from that tradition. I want to turn towards you, of course. But I wanted to start with your grandmother, the obvious place to start. I've been very struck by, the deep feelings of love for your grandmother and some of the poems. I'm thinking of poems like Heirloom in the New Selected Poems, Madras, November 1995, Winter Delhi, 1997. I thought it would be interesting for us, I suppose I'm very aware that you're coming from a very different world than many of us here. Mm. And it'd be nice to hear, it'd be good to hear about your grandmother, you know, her suitor when she was 8 that you write about. I wonder whether you start with her.
Well, it's a lovely place to start. My grandmother died just a couple of years ago at the age of 101. Mm. Yeah, she was quite a grand old lady. It's a good place to start. I'm going to see how I can find my way into it, Maitreya Bandhu. I have to just... let me see. I think... Let me start with the poem, really, mm. Heirloom, which for me was quite a deliberate attempt to write a poem that was romantic, because I wanted to be able to think about this woman. You know how it is with grandmothers. It just feels like they've been born old. Mm. And I wanted to just look at her and imagine what her early romantic career might have been like, you know. So it's an attempt to project, really, and to imagine. And that poem then gradually led me into this, into a kind of a certain, a wondering about what that kind of life must have meant. And I found that, for me, really, the most important lines in that poem was, when I talk about women who know their bodies as well as they know their minds, mm. that sense of integratedness, mm. which seemed to me to be part of a particular worldview, perhaps, to which I didn't feel I had access, mm. you know? So it just felt like a way of archiving a lost history, mm. which is, I suppose, the way many of us feel when we think back on women's histories, you know, which just don't get told enough. Mm. And certainly for my grandmother, who married at the age of 14 after resisting her first suitor at the age of 8, you know, it was a markedly different life. Mm. And yet it seemed to be a life of a woman who was able to stand by her choices with a remarkable degree of dignity. Mm. And I think that's what stayed with me.
I mean, the dignity really comes across, doesn't it? Your grandmother's dignity. Mm. And I was also thinking about your own childhood. You know, there's that lovely poem... I speak for those with orange lunchboxes.
Yes.
I wonder whether you can say something about that poem. I speak for, and bring, you know, bring your child self into the conversation almost.
Yeah, I'm glad you chose that poem. You know, there's a great. It seems to me sometimes that there is a great pressure on poets, maybe more so from the part of the world from which I come. A great pressure on poets to prove their political credentials, you know, to be able to prove that their politics are in the right place, their conscience is active and vigilant. And it's a fine thing to do. I have no problem with that at all. I have some strong poems, overtly political poems. Mm. But I've often wondered, if I had to be spokesperson for some constituency, what is the constituency that would make the mistake of electing me as its representative? You know, and it often seems to me that people are spokespersons for causes that haven't quite elected them. So I thought deep and hard, and then I finally felt this was my tribe, because this is what I do know. I do know what it's like to have been this shadowy figure on a school playground, standing with an orange lunchbox, watching the girls fight for the seesaw, being that observer, and knowing that the action is happening there, standing here and watching it. I seem to have spent a lot of time in the shadows, mm. in that sense. I know what it's like to be there. Mm. So I think, that's the kind of person I would like to pay tribute to in that poem.
The orange lunchboxes. And you say in an interview, I can't remember which way I found it, that you grew up in a house of books.
Yes,
I mean, I presume it wasn't built of books, but you know, I was wondering whether it was that, because you were writing from an early age, and wonder whether it was that got you into writing, into literature, and if it was, why particularly poetry?
Yes, I did grow up in a house of books, and it wasn't just poetry. In fact, I don't think my parents were major poetry enthusiasts, but they were very omnivorous readers. So there were books everywhere. Why poetry? I think it's really because, like many of us, I remember my earliest encounters with poetry at around 3 or 4, you know, just bits of nonsense rhymes in English, nursery rhymes in Tamil, bits of doggerel in Hindi. And I remember not understanding what most of it meant. You know, they were just fragmentary glimpses of meaning. But I do remember the sense of just being spellbound at the way in which language seemed to behave in poetry. You know, the ability of language to dive and soar and careen and swoop and do all kinds of unpredictable, dangerous things that it just didn't seem to do in this staid, prosaic, boring, grown-up world, you know? So that kind of, I think, is what I call a kind of verbal choreography that I felt poetry was in a kind of, unspoken way. I think I was aware of that as a child. And today, when I'm sometimes jaded by hanging around poems too much, and when I sometimes feel the need for a palate cleanser, I go back and remind myself of that early encounter with poetry when I knew intuitively that this is the way language was meant to be. It was meant to leap from one place to the other without joining the dots, you know? And that's what poetry is about, that it doesn't obey the laws of gravity in the way that prose does. I think I enjoyed those things about poetry.
And just to sort of locate it, in language, you know, you talk there about English and Tamil and Hindi. Did you grow up with all those three languages?
Yes.
You write in English, don't you?
I write in English, but like most Indians, I grew up polyglottal. You know, I grew up, my parents were Tamilian, but my mother had lived up north in Delhi, so she was very, you know, just as fluent in Hindi. Her grandparents had been in Burma. Her parents were in Burma. And my parents were third-generation English speakers, so English was very, very much the language we spoke at home as well. You know, when people often say, what is your mother tongue? You know, I always say my mother really spoke in many tongues. And English was certainly one of them. Also, I lived in the western part of India. So Hindi, Marathi, Gujarati, the cadences of those languages were very much in my ears as well. So English is the language that I think I can claim some measure of literary competence in, you know. Linguistic competence is another matter. I'm reasonably comfortable with some other languages. I would never be able to write poetry in any of them.
Interesting.
No.
So English is a natural language for you to write.
Yes. It's an Indian language. I certainly see it as an Indian language.
Particularly at the moment, it seems really good to think of English as an Indian language, isn't it?
I often like to say it's as Indian as democracy,
and
as Indian as cricket. So, yes. So, yes. Pretty much an Indian language.
Indeed. So I was struck, you know, by the title, just the title, Where I Live, and of the selected poems. And you say in an interview, I think in the Hindu, you talk about a gap between where I live and where I belong. And I wonder whether you could say more about that, this, what that gap means for you, a gap between where I live and where I belong. It seemed to be important to you, and it seems to run through the poetry.
It does, doesn't it?
A question about belonging, rooted in place, but not quite belonging. So,
yes.
Yeah.
With the second book, Where I Live, I realized that I had a manuscript ready, I think, when I discovered that the poems collectively seemed to be trying to address the gap between where I live and where I belong. I don't know where I, at least at the time that I wrote the book, I certainly didn't know where I belonged, but I knew where I didn't want to belong. So I think that edge is very much part of the poems, where I didn't want to belong culturally, where I didn't want to belong politically, where I didn't want to belong. It was also about looking at belonging in terms of actually inhabiting the body and what that means as well. So it was an attempt to look at belonging on different levels, I think. But the interesting thing is, I realized this only when God is a Traveler, the most recent book, happened. I realized that there's a shift in some way. I have no idea today where I live, because that's the kind of vagabond life I seem to lead. But I have a clearer sense of belonging, I think.
That's interesting.
Yeah?
That's
interesting. At least a deeper sense of anchorage.
And I was... Oh, yes, I should have told you. Thank you. I'm going to be in discussion for a while, then we're going to have a cup of tea, and then Arundhati will be reciting her poems. Yes, so this is supposed to warm you up to that. I hope you're getting warmed. So the other thing I wanted, and this is a sort of odd thing to say really, but you know, reading the poems, which I've really enjoyed and I really recommend, I thought they're vividly Indian, obviously. There's some lovely evocations of India. But they have this wonderful and unusual mix between wonder and scepticism.
Mm-hmm.
Between humour and warmth. They're sensual and intelligent. It's almost as if the poems are like a balancing act. They have this sort of poise. Even how they're on the page seem to sort of suggest a poise. I don't know whether that's whether, in your mind, a kind of poise between, for instance, scepticism and faith, between sometimes quite angry poems, even a sort of rage in the poems, without ever losing that poise, without ever losing that dignity. I wonder whether that chimes with you at all, or whether...
Yeah, I mean, I find that in... thank you. I mean, I find that an interesting observation. Whether I consciously work at it... No, but I do think I would probably work at... to me, to be able to write a poem that embraces contradictions, however messy those contradictions are, that to me matters. So I want to be able to, for instance, to write a poem that is very critical of a whole colonial heritage that is very much part of India's past.
Mm.
But I also want to be able to confess to my love of Keats.
Mm.
I want to be able to do both.
Mm,
you know, I want to be able to laugh at all the snobberies of my English medium education, and there were many snobberies. But I also want to be able to say that I enjoy juicy polysyllabic words. I do, you know, in English. So to be able to allow for both, you know, I'd like to write, however messy that makes a poem, I'd like to be able to make room for both.
Mm. Well, what's striking about the poems is that they don't become messy. You do seem to make room for both, don't you?
Thank you.
There's this sort of poise in them, as I said. And the other thing that struck me is how many of the poems are about writing poems.
Are they?
There's For the Poem Still Unborn, which really struck me. I think I thought I'd start our interview by saying, read that and tell me about that, because it really struck me. And then Hierarchies in Crisis, Printer's Copy.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much about a sense of poetry, a passionate sense, I think, that poetry matters, is important. I wonder whether you could say something about that, your sense that poetry matters.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, like many others, there was a time in which I thought of poems largely as magical verbal entities. And then, at one point in my life, I fell headlong into one of those blank spaces on a page of poetry. At least that's how I describe that experience.
Mm.
That's what it felt like.
Mm.
And when I started coming out of that, I began to realize that there are vast spaces inside me that cannot be mapped by language, as there are within all of us.
Mm.
And that's when I think I began to regard poems somewhat differently when I came back to them.
Mm.
And it took me a while to come back to them. I think I began to see poems much more as a very complex chemical compound of pause and word. And I approached pauses with a new respect, I think, because I realize how easy it is to be tripped up by those blank spaces on a page of poetry, and I was tripped up. I was derailed, really.
Mm.
So I approach those pauses somewhat differently now. I think that's how I would regard poetry.
Mm.
And that, for me, gave me a possible, perhaps a way to look at the way I live my life.
Mm.
So yes, poetry matters for that reason. That particular insight happened to me thanks to poetry.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, the other thing that strikes, you know, reading and myself is this lovely sense throughout of the beloved.
Mm.
Some of the poems, you can't quite tell whether they're the personal beloved. There's that one, You and I in Florence, for instance, I really, really loved. There's also When God is a Traveller, where there's a God looking through your eyes, which is really, really striking. This sense of the divine being very close, even erotic in the old-fashioned sense, I don't mean in the sort of smutty sense, but in the full sense of, you know, being inhabited by eros. Mm-hmm.
You know, Maitreya Bandhu, that's very much part of the bhakti poetry tradition that I spoke of.
Yeah.
You know, the bhakti poetry tradition is just this incredible tradition that doesn't allow you to make any kind of easy binary for yourself between the sacred and the sensual, between the body and the beyond. It's a constant reminder that the body itself is a tremendous site of intelligence, and that the body itself is a locus of knowing, you know. And the finest bhakti poets remind us of that. So for me, that inheritance is something that's that permeates the poems, I think. You know, I grew up with that, and then I reclaimed these poets for myself much later when my own spiritual journey took on a certain direction. I think it was very important for me to find a way to bring these poets back into my life and to just say that they deserve a hearing, because we need to hear these voices more than ever in a world that is constantly dividing, you know, the material and the metaphysical. To be able to say these two can be seen and experienced as inseparable, as inextricable, I think that's what these poems remind us of, you know.
And yet when you do that, is it what's striking is that you very much keep hold of your wit and your skepticism, don't you? You don't sort of fall into the arms of the beloved quite, although you do that. But
no, I don't.
You don't lose your mind. Do you?
I try not to.
Your head.
Yeah, because I think it's also about seeing, when I'm talking about various embracing various oppositions, it's also about seeing that I'm as much a person with, as we all are, with a mind, as I am with a body. And sometimes I feel that the cultural climate we live in compels us to believe that we have to choose. You know? So somehow you have to write the body, prove yourself, as you know, prove your credentials in a certain way, write the body, and this is what you must do. Or you, you know, or is your work intellectual? Does it have to be this or that? And I just wanted the right to own a mind and the right to own a body and that whole mess in between. You know, I wanted to make room for that, I think. But I'm sorry, you were also you said something else. Your question was also about, have I answered it?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
I
know I was heading off in some direction, but I forget what.
I was wanting to talk a little bit more about your own spiritual sense in the books. That's what, again and again, that returns in the poems, a kind of a spiritual sense. Could you say something about your own spiritual journey? You, for instance, in one interview, you say Eastern traditions, Buddhism in particular, has long been the source of fascination.
It has. I
mean, obviously, the word Buddhism comes
it has.
Out to me.
Yes, it has.
And perhaps how that, for you, relates to this sense of the beloved, which seems to be your primary metaphor for that, for you, the beloved, which I must say I'm very attracted to.
I think the whole existential journey, I mean, that trope has been there from the very first book. I realize that now when I look back on it. I believed that this particular thirst could actually be satisfied by reading philosophy, which I did in a very, in a ravenous and famished way at one point in my life. And then I found that while I was very drawn to it, Eastern and Western, there was one sliver in my cerebral cortex that it fulfilled, but that didn't seem to be percolating into the rest of me. So I turned then to the mystics. And the mystics from across, of all spiritual persuasions, were voices that spoke to me in a particular way, because they seemed to cut through this whole smog of doctrine and opinion and, you know, all the intellectual gymnastics that many of us are capable of, cut right through that. And it was so searing and so sharp that I realized that this could no longer be a journey that one undertook with just one little part of one's head or just one cranny in my left ventricle. It had to involve all of me. It had to implicate all of me. The spiritual journey too. So that meant coming out of the closet in a way and saying I can no longer just live this double or triple life where one is a functioning writer, cultural curator, journalist on the one hand, and leading this furtive inner life of quest On the other, it felt like, I have a line in one of the poems, it felt like the roof, you know, that I opened a coffee percolator and the roof had flown off. Mm. You know, that's the line from Confession. Mm. It felt a bit like that, that suddenly many walls had collapsed and I could no longer go back to being this particular person who played all these roles pretending that they were all mutually exclusive, because they aren't. They aren't. And Buddhism drew me for the fact that it seemed to be a way to talk about the self in the most uncluttered, unsentimental, psychologically penetrating way, the most psychologically penetrating way that I knew. And I felt very drawn to the quester figure of the Buddha, Gautama himself. Felt very drawn to that, because it seemed like this is a person who shared this quest, but he dared to stake his life on that quest, you know, which is not what many of us do. And so there's nothing lukewarm about any kind of poetry that can come out of that.
Indeed.
You know? Buddhism drew me for that reason, and subsequently yoga and, you know, and my own spiritual guide. Yoga not as just a set of spiritual, of physical postures, but yoga really is a path of self-integration that, you know, compels you again to look at every part of yourself and acknowledge it.
And then finally, I wanted to, I'm struck by that, and how it comes across to me in the poems, again, is that this sense that the poems reach out. They reach out to the saris in Textile, a lovely first poem in When God Was a Traveller. They reach out to gods. They reach out to people in the street. They reach out to friends. A lot of poems about friends.
Yes.
Friendship is an important part of the world of your poems. There's poems about wonder, sensualism, romance, the whole caboodle. So I wanted you to sort of say, you know, And you know, I'm thinking back to this sense that so many of the poems seem to be about writing poems. How has writing poems helped you, and how could it help us?
I don't want to preach to the converted. Huh? How do writing poems help me? They help me to inhabit a moment more fully than I would otherwise. They compel me to... It's a kind of vertical engagement with reality, isn't it? You have to just live here in this moment. To me, the lyric poem does that.
Yes.
And how do they help people? We all know how they help us. We, you know, doesn't change a thing, does it? No, poems certainly don't change a thing. And I always love to quote that particular line, which I discovered about, it's an anonymous quote. Someone who says that writing a poem is a bit like dropping a petal down the Grand Canyon and waiting for an echo. As ridiculous as that. And yet, we do it because echoes happen. Not huge reverberations, subtle echoes, quiet echoes, imperceptible echoes sometimes, but they happen. I think we all know that. And that's the only reason to be doing it, really. Otherwise, one should do something glamorous like write a novel. Right?
So that's a lovely place to end on subtle echoes, imperceptible echoes. And we'll be hearing some of those echoes after a brief cup of tea. Ladies and gentlemen, Arundhati.
Thank you.
So let's start again. I'm really pleased just to introduce Arundhati's reading. As I said, I've been reading them for the last wee while. I've been reading them before my meditations in the morning. The thing that I've been noticing about them so much is that they're this unusual mixture of funny and wise. Sometimes when people are wise, they can't bear to be funny. As if you're not supposed to be. And then quite often if people are funny, they're not very wise. But these poems really capture both. And I wanted to just read one tiny section from this lovely poem, Textile, where Arundhati talks about the darkening, widening meritocracy of the heart. The darkening, widening meritocracy of the heart. And that, I thought, just in that phrase, catches the poetry of Subhadraman. So, welcome.
Is this right? Should it not be higher?
No,
is this okay?
Yeah.
I thought I'd start with a poem from my most recent book. I was trying to explain to this friend of mine in Italy the notion of the Ishta Devta. The Ishta Devta is a personal god, which to my mind is one of the great gifts, one of the very unique gifts of India in terms of its own spiritual culture to the rest of the world. At its best, and it's not always at its best, but at its best, it is a culture that allows you to choose the god most suited to your taste and to your temperament. And you have 33 million gods and goddesses to choose from, almost as many people as there are. And this was at last count, so since that census, the number has clearly increased. And if you don't want any of these gods, you can make up one of your own. And if you don't want that either, you can skip God entirely, because the whole point of the journey is not God. The whole point of the journey is something else. Liberation, freedom, really. But I was just trying to explain the notion of a personal God to this friend, and then found I just couldn't get through. So I ended up writing a poem. How some Hindus find their personal gods. It's about learning to trust the tug that draws you to some shadowed alcove, undisturbed by footfall and butter lamps. A blue-dark coolness where you find him waiting patiently. That perfect minor deity, shy, crumbly, oven fresh, just a little wry, content to play a cameo in everyone's life but your own. A god who looks like he could understand errors in translation, blizzards on the screen, gaps in memory, lapses in attention. Who might even learn by rote the fury, the wheeze, the Pali, the pigeon, the gnashing mixer grinder, the awkward Remington stutter of your heart, who could make them his own. After that, you can settle for none other. Maitreya Bandhu mentioned a poem called Friends, and that's the one I'd like to read next. It's intended to be an affectionate poem about my friends, but it may not seem that way. And as I say, I'm always fully prepared to have my friends write similar poems to me. My friends. They're Sodom, the lot of them. Leafy, with more than a whiff of damage. Mottled with history. Dark, with grime. God knows I wanted them different. Less preoccupied, more jaunty, less handled with care, more airbrushed, less prone to impossible dreams, less perishable, a little more willing to soak in the sun. They don't measure up, they're unpunctual. They turn suddenly tuberous, but they matter for their endless distractions, their crooked smiles, their sudden pauses, signs that they know how green stems twist and thicken as they vanish into the dark, making their own way through sticky, vernacular tissues of mud, improvising, blundering, improvising. Sometimes when poets get together, they wonder why they're writing poetry, why they aren't doing something a little more glamorous, a little more high profile, a little more lucrative. One doesn't see royalty checks very often as a poet. And there's even apparently an American survey that claims that poets die sooner than other species of writers. And that must be true. It's American. For a poem still unborn. Over tea, we wonder why we write poetry. 10 people read it anyway. 3 are committed in advance to disliking it. 3 feel a vague pang, but have leaking taps and traffic jams to think about. 2 like it and won't mind telling you so, but don't know how. Another is busy preparing questions about pat ironies and identity politics. The 10th is wondering whether you wear contact lenses. And we, as soiled as anyone else, in a world addicted to carbohydrates and conversations without pauses, still groping among sunsets and line lengths and slivers of hope, for a moment unstained by the wild contagion of habit. Since we discussed grandmothers a little earlier, I'd like to read a poem about the last time I saw my grandparents. But of course, like all poems, it's not about grandparents alone. It's not about what it claims to be about. It's that, and hopefully more. Winter, Delhi, 1997. My grandparents, in January, on a garden swing, discuss old friends from Rangoon, chrysanthemums, the parliamentary session, an electricity bill. In the shadows, I eavesdrop. 8th grandchild, peripheral, half forgotten, enveloped carelessly by the great winter shawl of their affection. Our dissensions are ceremonial. I growl obligingly when he speaks of a Hindu nation. He waves a dismissive hand when I threaten romance with a Pakistani cricketer. But there is more that connects us than speech flavored with the tartness of old curd that links me fleetingly to her, and a blurry outline of nose that links me to him. And there is more that connects us than their daughter who birthed me. I ask for no more. Irreplaceable, I belong here like I never will again. My credentials never in question. My tertiary nook in a gnarled family tree, non-negotiable. And we both know they will never need me as much as I them. The inequality is comforting. There was someone here who told me she lived in Madras for a length of time. Is she here still?
Yes.
This poem is for you. I have a poem about Madras, and maybe it's the fact that I never lived in this South Indian city. I'm Tamilian, but I never lived there. Maybe it's because I've never lived there, I sometimes allow myself to get a little lyrical about it, in the way that I never would about Bombay, about which I also have several poems, but they're grittier poems. Madras. I was neither born nor bred here, but I know this city of casuarina and tart mango slices, gritty with salt and chili and the truant sands of the marina. The powdered grey jowls of film heroes. My mother's sari, hectic with moonlight, still crackling with the voltage of an M.D. Ramanathan concert. The flickering spice root of tamarind and onion from Mylapore homes on summer evenings. The vast opera of the Bay of Bengal flambéed with sun. And a language as intimate as the taste of sarsaparilla pickle, the recipe lost, the sour cadences as comforting as home. It's no use. Cities ratify their connections with you when you're looking the other way, annexing you through summer holidays, through osmotic memories of your father's glib lie to a kindergarten teacher. My mother is the fair one. And the taste of coffee one day in Lucca, suddenly awakening an old prescription, peabody, plantation A, and 50 grams of chicory from the fragrant shop near the Kapalishwara temple. City that creeps up on me just when I'm about to affirm world citizenship. This is a poem from my second book, which I think seemed to foreshadow, I realized when I looked back on the second book, seemed to foreshadow many of the themes that seemed to recur subsequently. In particular, the trope of the female quester, the vagabond woman seeker. Home. Give me a home that isn't mine, where I can slip in and out of rooms without a trace, never worrying about the plumbing, the color of the curtains, the cacophony of books by the bedside. A home that I can wear lightly, where the rooms aren't clogged with yesterday's conversations, where the self doesn't bloat to fill in the crevices. A home like this body, so alien when I try to belong, so hospitable when I decide I'm just visiting. Since we've done a particular kind of more mellow poem, I'm going to allow myself a rage poem. This is a rant of a poem, so you stand forewarned. It's a poem addressed to a Welsh critic. And I read it here not because the Welsh critic, you know, poor man, is of importance, really, even in the poem, although I've been quite savage about him. It's really a poem addressed to all those voices around us, and there are as many back home in India as there are elsewhere, voices that are telling us all the time how to belong. Voices that give us recipes for authenticity, blueprints for belonging. So it just felt like this is intended to be as much a critique of a particular kind of imperialism as it is meant to be a critique of nativism. But this particular poem is addressed to the Welsh critic. All those voices that tell us how to be woman, Hindu, Muslim, traditional, modern, post-colonial, contemporary, cutting edge. It's addressed to all of them. To the Welsh critic who doesn't find me identifiably Indian. You believe you know me, wide-eyed Inglit type, from a sun-scalded colony, reading my Keats, or is it yours, while my country detonates on your television screen? You imagine you've cracked my deepest fantasy. Oh, to be in an Edwardian vicarage, living out my dharma with every sip of dandelion tea and dreams of the weekend jumble sale. You may have a point. I know nothing about silly mid-offs. I stammer through my Tamil, and I long for a nirvana that is hermetic, odor-free, bottled in Switzerland, money back guaranteed. This business about language, how much of it is mine, how much yours, how much from the mind, how much from the gut, how much is too little, how much too much, how much from the salon, how much from the slum, how I say verisimilitude, how I say brahadaranyaka, how I say varaparam, it's all yours to measure. The pathology of my breath, the halitosis of gender, my homogenized plosives about as rustic as a malt-freshened global village. Arbiter of identity, remake me as you will. Write me a new alphabet of danger, a new patois to match the chola bronze of my skin. Teach me how to come of age in a literature you've bark-scratched into scripture. Smear my consonants with cow dung and turmeric and godhuli. Pity me, sweating, rancid, on the other side of the counter. Stamp my papers. Lease me a new anxiety. Grant me a visa to the country of my birth. Teach me how to belong the way you do on every page of world history. It needs a mellow poem. I'm going to find one. This is the poem I talked about earlier, about finding one's tribe, finding the tribe that I would like to be spokesperson for. I speak for those with orange lunchboxes. I speak for those with orange lunchboxes who play third tree in an orchard of eight in the annual school play, who aren't head girls, games captains, class monitors, who watch other girls fight for the seesaw from the far wall across the sandpit, who remember everyone's lines but their own, who still believe there'll be exams one day that they'll be ready for, who pelt after the school bus, their mother's breakfasts still lurching in their gut. Those with orange lunchboxes. I speak for them. I have several poems that are based on journeys of various kinds. And I was wondering whether to read the title poem, When God is a Traveller, but I think I'm going to read about another kind of journey, which is a journey made on an Indian local train, which for those of you who've made it and survived to tell the tale, you will agree, it's an absolutely matchless experience. And this is really a found poem, in a way. I don't really believe I had very much to do with this. This was a person I encountered who made her way quite effortlessly into a poem. Or take Mrs. Salim Sheikh. That's the title. Who ripples hospitably out of her halwa pink blouse and sari. Synthetics are so practical to wear on trains, no? Who invokes the protocol of Indian railways to ask for your telephone number even before the journey has begun. Who unwinds her life story, well oiled, without a single split end. She's Hindu, a doctor like her husband. The matron warned her about interfaith unions, but she had no doubts, not even in 93, when others did. Her ancestors supplied butter to Queen Victoria. His grandfather, better still, was Court Diwan of Kolhapur. I've been lucky, she says. The gods have been good. I eat and cook non-veg. Many of my friends are pure Brahmin. My sons are circumcised. My heart is pure. I practice no religion, only homeopathy. Over lunch, she remembers the day her mother-in-law died in her arms. I bathed her, she said. And when the body was taken away, I told my husband I wanted to be buried in the Kabristan. It's closer to our house than the crematorium. Take Mrs. Salim, Sheikh. It's time for a love poem, since you mentioned those as well. And maybe I will conclude with that, and maybe just one more. This is a poem called Where the Script Ends. His shirt is tangerine, the sky, Delft, the sunshine, daffodils. Even jealousy gleams brighter here than broccoli, stir-fried. In this daytime land, the canals speak an unambiguous tongue. We look over our shoulders for just a hint, a Venice. All languages are honest here, just none honest enough. At home, he speaks a dialect he's never written in, not even when his mother died. And I know what it is to live in a place where the mind's ink has many tributaries, fermented enough to make all stories and songs seem just a little untrue. It doesn't matter whether he reads my lips or I his Mandarin fine print, because it still makes sense, the old dream. Woman and man under a night sky, and for a moment between them, a single moon. I'm sorry, I did say it was the last, but I'm going to conclude with a poem that is truly the last poem, and I think it makes sense to conclude with it because it's called Prayer, and it's a poem from my very first book. And it feels like the right poem to conclude this evening with. Prayer. May things stay the way they are in the simplest place, you know. May the shuttered windows keep the air as cool as bottled jasmine. May you never forget to listen to the crumpled whisper of sheets that mold themselves to your sleeping form. May your pillows always be silvered with cat down and the muted percussion of a lover's breath. May the murmur of the wall clock continue to decree that your providence run 10 minutes slow. May nothing be disturbed in the simplest place you know, for it is here in the fetal hush that blueprints dissolve and poems begin. And faith spreads like the hum of crickets. Faith in a time when maps shall fade, nostalgia cease, and the vigil end. Thank you.
Privilege, doesn't it, to have been here? A real, real privilege to have been here. What a wonderful reader. What a wonderful reader. And you see that mixture of poise, gracefulness, poignancy, rage even, all wonderfully balanced together. I'm thinking it's a kind of gorgeousness, isn't it? A kind of gorgeousness. So you have friends, contact lenses, Remington stutters, grandparents, Madras, in this kind of gorgeousness. A really, really wonderful reading. Do buy the books. I'd really recommend them. We've got them at the back there. Do buy them. I'm sure Arundhati will be happy to sign them. Yes, yes, sir, that's great. So let's just thank her again for a really wonderful reading.